You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots community solar-powered radio here in the heartland.
And solar today, for sure.
It is solar today. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and happy birthday mom. My mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. And if you're listening on Monday morning, good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, it is a beautiful day. We've had unusually fine weather in Iowa. We're hoping for some rain because the crops are looking a little distressed. But, yeah, you know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah. And we have a really wonderful guest today. And I scheduled it today partly because this is Mom's birthday and I knew she would love this book.
I do. This book is, it has is chapters, and it's, you know, you can sit down and read one, you can read four or five. Each one you read, you think, oh, that's the best one. And then you read the next one, you think, no, that's the best one. Just because it is a collection of inspiring stories from doctors.
Miracles and Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories from Doctors by Nancy B. Kennedy. Tell us a little bit about Nancy, Mom.
Okay. Let's see. She has worked in newspapers for many years, including a stint with Dow Jones at the inception of its pioneering electronic financial news service. She has freelanced for numerous publications, including the New York Times and the online Wall Street Journal. She's authored five books, including those in the Miracle and Moments of Grace series, and she writes articles and personal essays for books, magazines, and newspaper.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Nancy.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here today.
Great. So, Miracles and Moments of Grace. This is not the first book that you've written with that title.
No, it's the second title in a series, and I was listening as you introduced me, and I was so glad to hear that you enjoyed the stories, because even as the writer, I read one story, and then the next, and then the next, and I think, oh, this one is my favorite, and then the next one is my favorite.
I know.
We decided to continue the series with this book of stories told by doctors. The first book in the series is a collection of inspiring stories from military chaplains.
Mm-hmm. But that's a good one,
too. In the same format, 50 stories, brief stories told in the first person by the person telling the story.
How did you gather all those?
Oh, the internet is a wonderful thing. I don't know how I did my job before its advent. I spend a lot of time searching and browsing. I get referrals from friends and people who have been in other books of mine. Sometimes, especially for the doctor book, I felt like a salesman cold calling people whose story I had read on the internet, and I'd hoped to encourage them to share them in my book. Facebook is a wonderful way to connect. It's almost like a universal phone book.
So when you found a story, like I noticed a lot of these came from blogs, so it was probably personal blogs of people or maybe hospital blogs. And when you found a story that intrigued you and you asked if they would share for the book, did anyone ever turn you down?
Oh, boy, let me think about that. Yes, that did happen. And I was always sorry when that did happen, but of course I understand. Although most people who wrote blogs and already had the story out there, or sometimes they would self-publish a book and so the story was already out there, generally had no objection to getting a wider audience. And I found that both doctors and chaplains tended to write blogs or books or journals as a kind of a way to process these experiences, because of course both doctors and chaplains, military chaplains, are in some very dramatic situations, filled with emotions of all sorts.
Of course. And in the case of doctors, too, I imagine they have to go from one patient to another, especially if they're working in, for instance, many of these were in Kenya and in Haiti, places where they're just setting up a clinic. they see some very, you know, difficult cases, one after another. What can I do? How can we help? And so to be able to isolate those then and write about them, it must be difficult.
You're absolutely right, Carolyn. When I talk to doctors, I kind of thought, well, maybe they're just going to be bored by what they see every day, the runny noses and the rashes that we all go in for. So I did find that the people that were most, that came forward first to tell stories were those, like you say, that were on mission fields and they saw very extreme conditions that you wouldn't see here in the States because of our health care. The same for doctors who had inner city clinics, and several of the doctors in the book have clinics where they treat people who are uninsured or underinsured, and it seems like to me that God gives them a lot of grace and a lot of miracles in those situations.
What were you looking for in stories to include in your book?
I had several ideas. You know, there are doctors that write their own books. For example, there's a doctor who writes about his work as an emergency room doctor. I think his book is called Angels in the ER. So I thought, okay, there are doctors out there talking about their specialty. I wanted to get, you know, I had a lot of room. I have 50 stories. So I wanted to get the broadest possible representation, all sorts of doctors, OBGYNs, trauma, neurosurgeons, dentists, missionary doctors. I've got a lot of different, every story you're in a different environment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what else? Was there something, you know, about a particular, you know, how did you know when you had found a story that fit?
Yeah, how did I know? Yeah, I wanted stories that would grab you, and I'm a fairly unemotional person, just the facts, you know, brought up writing for newspapers, but I would talk to these doctors, and I'd immediately feel tears springing in my eyes, and I'd think, okay, this is a story that I want. This is a story that touches you at the heart level. I also looked for stories, you know, it could be pretty, if it were one trauma after the next, it could make for pretty hard reading. So I was sure that in the doctor's profession, as well as anyone else's, there are going to be moments of humor, moments of joy. I wanted to cover the wide spectrum of emotions that a doctor would encounter with his patient, his or her patients.
I'm sure that not all doctors are emotionally capable of going to on a mission trip either, because of the difficulties that they see, and that must take a certain type of person to be able to do that, I would think.
I think you're right. I think what amazed me most about it was that these are, you know, doctors with their own practices, or, you know, very busy doctors,
right,
doing, you know, having full days, and yet they wanted to go on mission trips. They wanted to volunteer at a clinic. They wanted to be a doctor at a camp for diabetic children. It just seemed like they just didn't, they loved their profession so much they didn't want to go home.
We have a couple of doctors in Mount Pleasant, where I live, that went on a mission trip to Kenya last year, and they're going again next year. And one of them has been several times. And, you know, I'm going to have to sit down with them and get some of their stories, I think.
Oh, yes. That's a great idea. Well, Nancy, you mentioned you grew up as a journalist. You know, you came up as a journalist, writing for Dow Jones. That would be, I think, pretty business-oriented. And what led you to write the Miracles and Moments of Grace series? How did you transition from being a business writer to writing these heartfelt stories?
I know, isn't that funny? Life is quite a journey. Yeah, I have my degree in journalism. I graduated from Penn State and immediately started working in daily newspapers as an editor and a writer. Did all the things that cub reporters do, obits, police blotter. And then, yes, I transitioned into business, took a job with Dow Jones, didn't know what a stock or a bond was, but learned it all on the job. And I love business news. I loved reading the Wall Street Journal every day for my job. I couldn't imagine anything better than that. And I did that for a number of years. And then when I was a freelancer, I still stayed with the financial news, and I wrote syndicated columns about the things we all face, retirement planning, paying for your kids' college, mortgages. And I loved that for a very long time. But I had a midlife transition. I became a mother at age 41. And after that, I just realized you can't live the journalist life. The deadlines are too pressing. If you can't take the phone call because your child is awake and you're feeding your child, you don't get the story. So I began to think about what I would be doing next, and it was actually my son that helped me make the transition. When he was a toddler, of course, in Sunday schools and preschools, there's a lot of arts and crafts, and the kids are forever bringing home things. Well, my son hated arts and crafts. And I did too. I can't make anything out of cotton balls and plastic cups.
Popsicle sticks.
I started to see what excited him, and I realized we did a couple of very small science activities in the kitchen, and we both loved it. And I thought, well, how can I take this love he has for science, and can I take that to make Bible stories memorable in the same way that Sunday school teachers do that with arts and crafts? Mm-hmm. So I came up with this, again, it was, I guess I do collections. I came up with this collection of 44 science activities and tied them to Bible stories. And
wow.
I published that book and another book with Concordia, the Lutheran publishing house.
Wow.
So that kind of began my transition into books. And after I did those couple of children's books, my heart was always back, in the real world with, with adults. I seem to connect better. I'm so thankful for Sunday school teachers and preschool teachers and elementary school teachers because they know what they're doing and I don't. But I eventually came up with this idea for the stories, for the military chaplain stories, and my publisher has been so gracious to allow me to extend that into a series.
So the book with the science projects was titled Make It, Shake It, Mix It Up?
Yes, that was the second one. That's okay. For older children, perhaps grades 2 through 5. The first book is called Even the Sound Waves Obey Him, and that's for preschoolers to second graders.
Oh.
Each one has 44 activities.
Wow, that's a great resource. Wonderful.
We sure had a lot of fun in the kitchen.
I bet. So did you credit your son in those books?
Oh, what an interesting question. I don't remember. I did talk about the activities that we did, and there was one wonderful day when Evan decided he was going to do a science activity that I hadn't showed him, and he got out a glass of water and a tube of toothpaste and started squirting the toothpaste until it was all over and the water was dripping down the counter, and I thought it was wonderful that he was had taken the initiative. I wasn't worried at all about the mess.
He was experimenting.
That's right.
That's right. So Nancy, when you started collecting these stories from doctors and Did you have the structure already set?
That's right. Military chaplain book. The series is very similar to Chicken Soup for the Soul books.
Right. Right.
Where you hear from the person, him or herself, which I love, and so it's first person, and so that you know it's a real story, and The stories are brief, not more than a couple of pages. People have told me that they've read it cover to cover, while other people will say, oh, I use it as a devotional, and I read one story every night.
Yeah, yeah, that's when I say you could do that. So do you have to edit the stories very much? I mean, or, you know, when people tell you the story, do you have to cut it down then to fit your format? Or?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, because it's a collaboration, which I love. Sometimes the stories, I can just paste them right in, and other times, particularly when they're taken from blogs or a book and they're taken out of context, the reader's not going to really know the full what's going on, so we need to do a little bit of editing, mm-hmm. round it out a little bit, introduce all the characters. Some of the doctors and some of the chaplains just told me their story on the phone, and I just took on the old reporter role and took notes and listened to the rhythms of their speech, and I would write the story up for them and return it to them for their review, so that we were all happy with the end result.
Would you go back and forth many times on some of them?
Everyone is different. Some folks, and I love these folks, they would just send me an email and say, it's great, don't change a thing. those I liked. And other times it was a lot of back and forth. In fact, I'm working right now on the third book in the series, and there seems to be a lot more back and forth with this book. But in the end, we always get to a final version.
In the third book is based, are you willing to share who you're interviewing for that?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes.
It's and you'll love this. It's a book of stories told by mothers.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, next week our guest is Christine Carlson, who wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Moms.
Oh,
so,
great.
Yeah, so that'll... that fits right in with what you're working on. So the mothers, that must in a way be more difficult because you have, there's so many mothers and they all have stories.
That's
so,
right. But
yeah.
I'm finding, and this is very interesting, for the first two books, for the chaplains and the doctors, the stories that were most thrilling were those that we didn't, you know, they're just amazing stories. They're totally out of the realm of our experience. They're on the battlefield. They're in the emergency room. You know, we don't know. They shed a light on these worlds that we know nothing about. But for the mother book, I'm finding that the best stories are the ones that we all can relate to because we've been there. We've spent a horrible day with our toddler. We have a wonderful birth story for our children. You know, it's just, I'm finding that those are the stories that speak most to the heart, or the ones that, where the emotions are all familiar to us because we've been there.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. Now, with the military chaplains, I'd say there's a limited pool of military chaplains to draw from, but how did you get in contact with them?
Actually, the chaplains were far easier than the doctors, and I thought it would be the other way around.
Yeah.
Oh. Every military chaplain must be endorsed by an endorsing agency sponsored by their denomination. So there are about maybe 200 or 225 of these agencies, and I would contact these agencies, call them up or send them an email and tell them what I was up to and ask if they wouldn't mind sending out an email to their chaplain list to see if anybody wanted to respond. So I got a lot of stories that way. And it went, you know, the first 30 or 40 just went very, very quickly.
Well,
the doctors, I felt more like a stalker. I had to grab their stories one by one. There wasn't that sort of go-between that I could get to.
Even if you had published things in doctors' newsletters or something like that, the doctors are so busy, it's unlikely that very many would have responded, I would think. Yeah.
Yeah, I did make, I don't know, I didn't count, but maybe, I don't know, maybe two phone calls or three phone calls or four phone calls for every one that was successful. I don't know. I made a lot of phone calls.
Right. And What made you decide to write about, to tell military chaplain stories to begin with?
Well, that one was unusual because, again, it was totally out of left field for me. I don't know any military people. I'm a baby boomer, but on the tail end, so I didn't know anybody who had been drafted in Vietnam, or, you know, my dad was a only son in a farm family, so he didn't serve. So it was just totally out of my experience, but one night, my husband and I hosted an old friend of mine, someone I knew in my teens and hadn't seen for 30 years, and he was an Air Force chaplain. And we sat around the dining table, and he told me a story about a package that my husband and I had sent him when he was deployed in Afghanistan. And it was one of these wonderful stories that just showed God's provision with the exact amount of something that he needed. And after he finished his story, he turned to me and he said, "You know, Nancy, we chaplains have hundreds of these stories." And it was just, you know, that light that went on in my head. I'd been looking for an idea for a book, and I just thought, oh, yeah, I want to write these stories. This is what I want to do.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And how long did you work on that project?
Each book has taken me about a year to write.
Okay. And how did you go about finding a publisher? Because I'm talking more about the chaplain book because I'm... Once you had that publisher, then obviously this one followed along. But so tell us a little bit about the process of finding a publisher for you.
Oh, every writer has a sob story, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I'm no different. My first two books, the children's books, I contacted publishers ad infinitum, one after the other, rejection after rejection after rejection. Until finally I'd gone on vacation, I came back, and there was a message on my machine saying that, you know, this publisher was interested in the book. Was it still available? So, you know, great celebration. Mm-hmm. And then after those two books, I had been... It's very difficult to get your work considered by publishers if you're not represented. A lot of publishers want to know that you have an agent, that the agent has vetted you. You know, the agent, just by virtue of his involvement, he is saying that you're publishable.
Right.
So
right.
And the thing that got me was that every bit of advice I had said, well, publishers want to know that you're willing to invest in your career. So that means you have to spend $1,000 on this writer's conference. Mm-hmm. So I went to several writer's conferences, and I'm trying to think of how it actually happened. I had an idea for another book, a different book, and I'd actually written it start to finish. And I met my agent at a conference, and at these conferences you get to sign up for these 15-minute, it's like speed dating. You get to present your idea to an agent or to a publisher, or you sit down with a writer and they help you form your idea. So I sat down with this one agent with my idea, and he said, yeah, sounds good, send it to me. So after the conference I sent him that proposal. Turns out, didn't like the idea, hated the idea, but he liked me, and I liked him, and we started talking, and I don't even know how long it was before we finally came up with a workable idea. Even before the chaplain book, we came on another idea for a book, and actually, it was published last year. The chaplain book beat it into publication, so my agent has helped me so far, have three books published and working on the fourth.
Great. We're talking today with Nancy Kennedy, author of Miracles and Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories from Doctors. And the one that you wrote before the chaplain book but published slightly after, I'm guessing, is How We Did It, Weight Loss Choices That Will Work for You.
That's right. Yeah. I'm just like any reporter. I go from one idea to the next. I had lost weight myself, and I started to become very interested in how people lose weight, because if you read weight loss blogs, I was finding that most people talked about why they weren't losing weight and what their problems were and what their struggles were. And I thought, well, surely somebody's been successful. I want to hear about that. So I actually wrote that book first. For that book, I interview maybe about 30 people who they all lost weight a different way. This is what I love about that book. Everybody wants you to believe that their way is the only way. You know, the latest diet guru, and their book is on the top 10 list. But I wanted to investigate how people did it in different ways. So I wanted to find one person who would represent all the major plans that we hear about: Weight Watchers, Atkins, South Beach, you know, all the major plans, just to show, look at all these different ways that people have met their goal, and maybe one of these plans would work for you too.
Now, is that book published by the same publisher as the Miracles and Moments of Grace series?
It is. Yes. Leafwood Publishers has published all three of my books for the adult market.
Great. So you were able to publish in the children's market without an agent, but you felt like you needed an agent to get it into the adult market. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say that's accurate. I just felt after those two books, it was more clear to me how many doors would be open if you were represented. Mm. And, you know, being a reporter, I don't think I'm any better a writer than anybody else. I just think being a reporter, I keep going until I get what I want.
Well, the standard wisdom says, like you said, that you do need an agent, and that, but also that in some ways it's harder to get an agent than to get a publisher.
You're right there. It's equally as hard to get an agent or a publisher.
Yeah.
So, of course, writers are trying every route available.
Now, with all of your rejections on your children's books, you probably don't beat the chicken soup record for rejections.
I was going to ask you to say that, tell you that, because that's...
Have you submitted stories?
No, but we've interviewed authors of some of the chicken soup series, and the original book, I believe, was rejected 140 some times before they sold it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have, and I think I've lost count, maybe three, maybe four stories in chicken soup books.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And I found that it's funny, but it's just like the Wall Street Journal. There are formats, and once you've got that down, once you know what they want, it's easier to replicate it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Miracles and Moments of Grace has some similarity to the chicken soup, but it seems like the way you went about it was a little different.
It is. I'm really glad that you noticed that.
Yes.
Chicken soup books, from my experience, you submit and they run it practically word for word. And the reason they can do that, of course, is they're such a big name, and they probably get hundreds of thousands of submissions, and they can just skim off the top 100. I'm not well known, and so I get my calls for stories out there, and sometimes they come in from writers, and sometimes they don't. So, my stories, my books are kind of a compilation of my work and somebody else's work. It's truly a collaboration, and I really like that, because I don't want to be a writer sitting here in my lonely turret starving. You know, I like working with other people, and I love the writer-editor relationship, and that's often what the relationship I'm in with the people in my book.
But you actually get to play both sides of that in what you're doing. You get to be the writer and the editor.
That's right. And I've been both. I've been on both sides of the desk in my career, and I love both sides.
Now, with each story, you have a little bio of the person whose story it is. And do you write the bios, or do the
That's a collaborative work as well. With the doctors and the chaplains, I would say they're a little bit more hands-off. My mother, the moms in my next book, many of them are writers, and they're perfectly happy writing their own bios.
So
I'm finding I'm more of an editor this time around.
Now, do you also work with another editor at the publishing company on these books?
That's right, I do. I have an editor who helps me form the books, and then at the very end, when I turn in the manuscript, there is another editor who looks it over and sends it out to a copy editor.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a lot of eyes on the manuscript.
Yeah, there is.
So, Nancy, you found your agent, and then how difficult was it for him to place these books for you?
He's an amazing guy. Can I just mention his name
sure,
here?
Sure.
Bill Jensen. He's been in publishing a long, long time. He was with many well-known publishers, Multnomah, Crossway, Harvest House. And he will tell you, the minute you tell him an idea, he can tell you whether he can sell it or not. Mm. He knows right away what the market wants.
Huh.
And so he deflected a couple of my ideas before we came to one that he knew he could. And every time he's told me he could sell a book, he has.
So you trust him?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And now publishers, you know, because of his track record, publishers are willing to take his word for it.
Mm, that's great. So you really have somebody in your corner.
Yes, that's a great feeling.
Yeah.
I've done book talks at bookstores and libraries where I've met up with authors who are self-published and not represented, and it's such a struggle from that level. I know that I'm among the fortunate few who have gotten this far, and I'm forever grateful for it. It's a privilege.
We're talking with Nancy Kennedy today here on Writer's Voices, and she's the author of, among other books, Miracles and Moments of Grace, stories, inspiring stories from doctors. So, Nancy, let's talk a little bit about that. How much, you know, we've talked to various writers, and things have changed in terms of how much publicity the publishing company actually will do and how much the writer's responsible for doing themselves, and as far as book tours and so forth. And also that part of when a publishing company is deciding whether or not to publish a book, only the quality of the writing and the topic are obviously very important, but perhaps equally as important is the ability of the author to publicize the book and to have a platform of their own. So
you've talked to a lot of writers. I can tell that word platform.
Yes. So what's
we all hate it.
So what's your platform?
Well, you know, the great thing about this internet age is that anyone can have a platform. Platform used to mean, are you, do you speak at women's ministries or women's retreats? Do you have a speaking ministry? Are you a pastor? Are you a conference speaker? And those of us who weren't were just out of luck because we didn't have an audience. But now you can blog, you can have a website, you can have Facebook pages, you can build your own platform virtually,
right.
And it works even better than you know, you used to, and still do. You still go out to book events, and you still give talks, and you might get 20 people at a library talk, or you might get 300 at a conference, but, you know, the internet is endless.
That's true. Well, Nancy.
Well, yeah, that platform discouraged me for a long time because I thought I don't have a platform. But we've definitely found ways to create one. One of the best things is, and it does take a lot of work. You're right. Writers have to do a lot of publicity, and one of the best ways of creating that platform is to find the absolute right place to display your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can talk about this on your program, but the Military Chaplain book is, my publisher was able to get it into Cracker Barrel. So Cracker Barrel stores carry the Military Chaplain book, and that is just the perfect place for it. there's nothing I could do better to display what kind of a book it is and what the audience, what audience it should have.
Well, that's interesting, and it's also very creative of your publisher, too.
Very creative, and they stuck with it. They're not easy. It's not easy to get something placed in those stores, and my sales team just kept at it for a year or more.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I noticed that the Miracles and Moments of Grace, you know, a lot of nonfiction books have sort of a category shown on the back, and that's so bookstores know where to display it, or, you know, where it fits.
Mm-hmm.
And yours is in Christian inspiration. But not all of your storytellers are Christian.
You are so perceptive. the label that they have to put on a book is very limiting, and there's not a lot you can do about it. But I wanted to speak to, with my stories, you know, I've always lived in, I don't like this separation between the secular world and the Christian world. I live in a community, a small town, where my life is integrated, and I interact with neighbors and with fellow parents and with my church family, and I don't want to have this artificial separation. So I really, with my books, I wanted to make sure that I could speak to everyone. Mm-hmm. And my publisher is a wonderful publisher who understood my heart and wanted to help make that happen.
That's great. That's great.
So even though it says, for example, Christian inspiration on the military chaplain book, I have Protestant chaplains and Catholic chaplains and Jewish chaplains. I'm so grateful that my publisher allowed me to cast a net like that.
That's great. That's great. So for the doctor's book, how many stories? There's 50 stories in the book, but did you have more than that to start with, and you winnowed down?
Well,
or not so much.
For the doctors, I really had to go after the stories one by one. It wasn't that I sat down and turned on my computer and my inbox was full. So basically, I went after the stories that I wanted the most. And there's actually, I think, maybe 52 or 53 in the doctor book, because I think there's one chapter where I got two stories from doctors who were in Haiti after the earthquake, and I kind of put them together as a package.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another doctor in the doctor book who told me two stories, and I just couldn't choose between them.
Yeah.
So I have one story of his in the book, and then I also repeat one of his stories in the introduction.
Oh, and that was a great story. Yeah, that really was.
They're all great stories.
I also noticed in the introduction that you quoted Dr. Alan Hamilton, who we had on Writer's Voices a number of years ago.
Did you?
Yeah, with The Soul and the Scalpel.
Oh, that was fantastic
or the,
book.
Fantastic. Or The Scalpel and the Soul, something like that.
Yeah.
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 And he said, he talks about the in your book, you quote him saying, "I always wish someone had said that you're going to see stuff that is going to make you question your values. You're going to question yourself. And that is part of medicine and part of taking care of human beings. Maybe it is the mystery of taking care of life." So that was a great quote from him.
And that was so true. So many, not so many, but several of the doctors did tell me about their early years of medical training, when they were just overwhelmed with what they were facing and questioning, do I really want to do this? Is this really the place for me?
I can understand how that could very well happen. Yeah.
Well, Nancy, I don't know how they get through those early years.
Nancy, before we get too late, let's have you read a couple stories.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
Okay, you got to read.
Okay,
like
we have a, we have a request.
Like to be read too.
We have a request of one of the ones.
Yeah,
if possible, is it?
I need to see the baby.
I need to see the baby.
Oh, really? That's the one you want?
Yes.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, I love
that's
that.
What, page 101.
Yes. It's fantastic.
This is a story by Dr. Christopher Bloss. He's an OBGYN who practices in Troy, New York. It's entitled, "I Need to See the Baby." And actually, Dr. Bloss, just to give you an example of how I got to these stories, He was a doctor of a fellow author of mine. I contacted her and asked her if she knew of any doctors, and she gave me his name. So I'll just start right in.
All right.
Sometimes, because of your own experiences, you become a better doctor. I have something of a reputation as being more like a midwife than a doctor. I really empathize with my patients, especially when something is wrong. That's because I've been there. My wife Jen and I had difficulty conceiving. We used fertility treatments for the birth of our first three children. We just knew that nothing was ever going to happen the old-fashioned way. Then, one year, around the holidays, my wife began to have trouble with what we thought was her gallbladder. She'd had gallbladder trouble before. The pain, nausea, and fatigue persisted this time and became increasingly intense. Finally, she decided she needed to see her doctor. Before making an appointment, Jen thought she'd better take a pregnancy test just to be sure she could take any medicine she was prescribed. I was in the shower when Jen came into the bathroom. "What do I do next?" she asked, holding out the wand. The test was positive. I did an ultrasound and determined that she was 8 weeks pregnant, something we never thought could happen. Everything looked fine. It didn't look like she needed anything, no betas, no progesterone, nothing to help this baby along. The pregnancy progressed normally. The lab work all came back good, and the baby's growth was right on target. The baby was active, kicking all along. We had no worries. As an OBGYN, I took part in a regular rotation at one of our local hospitals. Once or twice a month, I'd do an overnight shift on the labor and delivery floor, handling emergencies and C-sections. Sometimes, my wife would come to the hospital with our kids to have dinner with me. On one occasion, about 2 weeks before her due date, we enjoyed dinner together as usual. She was getting the kids ready to leave when our five-year-old Elizabeth stopped her. "I want to see the baby," she said. "I want to see the baby on the ultrasound." Elizabeth is normally a laid-back child, not one to seek attention, but on this occasion, she was adamant. Her urgency was unusual. She kept pushing us, even as we tried to dissuade her. We thought there was no reason for it, since the baby was due so soon. "No," she said, "I need to see the baby." Finally, she wore us down. "Okay, fine," I said. We went into the room with the ultrasound equipment, and my wife lay down, and I started the scan. I'm very comfortable with sonography. I'd performed ultrasounds throughout my residency, and for 6 months, I was a sonographer at my first practice. At first, looking around, I didn't see much out of the ordinary. But when I began to investigate, I noticed something off about the amniotic fluid. My wife was 38 weeks along. Her amniotic fluid should have been much greater than it was. In fact, she should have had about three times as much fluid as I was measuring. At the same time, I was astonished to find that my measurements indicated a baby at 35 weeks along rather than 38 weeks. The medical term for this anomaly is intrauterine growth restriction. Something was preventing the baby from growing. I quietly continued the scan. I wasn't saying anything at this point, and my wife noticed. "Chris, what's wrong?" she asked. What I was seeing, poor growth and oligohydramnios, or low fluid levels, wasn't good news. We had to get my wife delivered right away, or our baby was likely to be stillborn. I called the midwife at our practice. Being the husband and the father, I didn't want to rely on my own advice alone. My partner in the practice was on vacation, so it was just the midwife and me. She agreed that the baby should be delivered as soon as possible. I made a quick call to the chairman of the department, and he came in to cover the hospital's in-house calls. Jen's mom, who lives 2.5 hours away, started out for our house. Our midwife arrived at the hospital, and I drove the kids home. A couple from our church came over to stay with our children until Jen's mother arrived. I packed a bag and drove back to the hospital. Our first step was to induce labor, but it was a tricky business. Jen had had a C-section with our first child, so we had to be careful about which drugs we used, as some induce very strong contractions. We started Jen on a low dose of Pitocin. Midway through the night, though, when we saw little progression, we decided we needed to move things along. The next step would be to break her water. I was reluctant to do this because fluid cushions the umbilical cord and prevents dangerous changes in the baby's heart rate. But after consulting with the midwife and the department head, I went ahead and broke her water. As the ultrasound had shown, there was very little fluid. Jen's contractions became intense and labor progressed quickly. She'd opted for a water birth, and when the time came for delivery, Our baby girl, Michaela Grace, was born with no trouble. She was just 5 pounds, 5 ounces, but she was clearly healthy. I was relieved that we had made the right decision. The error rate in determining growth is plus or minus 2 weeks. It could have turned out that I'd put us all through this for no reason at all. But the small amount of amniotic fluid confirmed our decision. The reality is that we averted a terrible fate. Babies in this situation have a fourfold increase in stillbirth. If it hadn't been for our daughter Elizabeth and her insistence on seeing the baby that night, we could have been among those statistics. Yet today, Michaela's doing fine. She's tiny, only in the 10th percentile in terms of weight and height, but she's a spunky little person. I don't know why God chose to bless us in this way. I've delivered stillborn babies and babies that are too premature to survive. I'm moved to pray for every woman whose delivery I attend. God, let her know you're there for her, I pray. Give her strength and energy. It was a privilege to help deliver our baby, and I'm not the only one who feels this way. Elizabeth is so pleased to have played a part in the safe delivery of her sister. She's a very humble child, yet to this day she's proud to tell us, I got to be used by God. Mm-hmm. To me, the experience speaks to God's power and to his providential love.
Oh, that's such a great story.
I need to see the baby. That was Nancy Kennedy reading one of the 52 stories in Miracles and Moments of Grace. Nancy, do you have a favorite in the book?
Oh, No. I was reading through them today just to prepare for our interview, and I just thought, I truly do love every story.
Yeah, I know.
If you want me to read another one, there's one that means a lot to me because my dad told me that when he read it, he just thought, he told me, this book is even better than the first one.
Aww.
And to hear that from my dad was...
We'd love to hear that one.
Yes.
It's the first book in the story. It's from Dr. Ron Eaker. It's actually the first story that I received for the book. I didn't put them in the order that I received them, but I just thought this was a wonderful story to start the book off with. Dr. Eaker is an OBGYN as well, so this is another baby story.
Yeah, that's a great one.
He practices in Augusta, Georgia. The late great philosopher and hunka-hunka-burnin'-love Elvis once sang a tune called Blue Christmas. It was a hit largely because it resonated with all those who feel depressed during the holidays. Feeling blue over the holidays is epidemic. Some studies indicate that more than 30% of the population suffers from this seasonal malady. I'll never forget the beautiful 18-year-old I cared for one Thanksgiving in the emergency room. She'd slashed her wrists with a razor blade and barely made it to the ER alive. Yet she did survive, and over the next several days I got to know her better. I finally asked her why she'd tried to take her life. She said simply, I had no hope. But every year around the holidays, I also find myself remembering another patient, Lisa. Her story is one of hope rather than hopelessness. I first saw Lisa in the afternoon on Christmas Eve. She'd been in labor for about 8 hours. I'd never met her before. I was on call for our practice and just coming on duty. She was only halfway there, and it was obvious from looking at her why it's called labor. Sweat was rolling off her brow, and her expression was one of fear, expectation, and pain all wrapped up together. She continued to progress, each contraction harder than the previous one. Her breathing became panting, and those little beads of sweat became a drenching shower of effort. I would periodically pop in to check her progress, and each time I noted her resolve and quiet determination. She knew that her pain was all for a greater purpose. As she came closer to delivery, Lisa reached the state known as transition. This is often the stage of labor where Miss Manners' decorum is utterly abandoned. She negotiated these final moments heroically, pushed effectively, and delivered a beautiful baby girl. Almost immediately, I noticed a problem with the baby's eyes. They were widely spaced, more so than normal. Then I saw her club foot. When I examined her further, it became obvious that this beautiful baby girl had Down syndrome. As I carried this newly swaddled baby over to her eager mother, I struggled with how to tell her of my suspicions. The moment of a child's birth is such an emotional event, the moment most parents consider the highlight of their lives. Hearing this news can feel like a slap in the face. In their fear and confusion, a new parent doesn't even know how to react. I said a quick prayer and decided to be forthright. As I laid the infant on Lisa's belly, I gently placed my hand on her shoulder and told her that I thought the baby had Down syndrome. Then I showed her the baby's club foot. Lisa paused for what seemed like an eternity, her eyes never leaving her baby. Finally, she spoke. "Isn't God great?" she said. That caught me totally off guard. It was definitely not the response I'd expected. Then she continued, "God knew to send this baby to someone who would love her just as she is," she said. With that, Lisa drew her left arm out from under the bedsheets. For the first time, I saw that Lisa's own arm and hand were deformed, her fingers fused and malformed. When a child is born, parents bristle with the joy of unbridled hope. Hope for their child's health, hope for their future, hope for a life of meaning and purpose. Sometimes those hopes are dashed. But just as 2,000 years ago, the birth of a baby boy to a young mother in a shabby horse stall was a portent of hope, the birth of this baby was an amazing source of hope and joy for Lisa. Yes, God is indeed good and wise.
That was a great story to start
out. I can see why you like that one too. Yeah.
Oh, if you have time, I'll have to read all 50 of them to you.
the one about the veteran who was agonizing all of his life because he thought he had done something terrible in war.
That story just stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah. Imagine carrying that guilt all your life.
Yeah, here was a man who was ill in his last days.
Uh-huh.
He had some heart troubles, but the doctor suspected that his suffering was much more than it should be given what his diagnosis was. The man was struggling to breathe. He couldn't sleep at night. He was having night terrors, and the doctor was giving him sleep medication, anti-anxiety medication, and nothing seemed to be working. So he finally, and I'm surprised to hear this, but he made a house call. A couple of doctors in the book made house calls and sat down with the man and said, "Let's get to the bottom of this. You know, why aren't you sleeping? Why are you having such trouble?" And the man sent his wife out of the room and told a story to the doctor of when he had been a soldier in World War II, how he'd been stationed on a Pacific island. He was on patrol one night, and he rounded a corner in his Jeep and came upon a group of about 30 Japanese soldiers who were raising a flag in surrender. Without even thinking, the man picked up a machine gun and mowed them all down, killed them all. For his entire life, this man kept this secret. He never told anyone that this had happened. He didn't seek help from anyone. And this story came pouring out of him in front of this doctor, Dr. Avery, a hospice doctor, but at the time just an internist. And the doctor at first didn't understand. You know, he kind of just tried to brush it off. You know, it was war. You were young. It was an instantaneous decision. But the man persisted. He said, "I'm a murderer." And then the doctor realized suddenly this man had seen himself as a murderer for his entire life and finally got to the root of this man's struggle. Well, with some help, the man agreed that they could share the story with a chaplain and with his church's pastor. And the man eventually, within a couple of weeks, decided to tell his family the story. And they all sat down again in the same living room, and he told them his story. And, of course, everyone forgave him. They were just relieved to find out what the problem, why his life was ending in such stress and difficulty. And after that, the man breathed much easier. He slept better. And about a month later, he died in peace.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that doctors today are having a very difficult time with our returning veterans because of the terrible things that they've seen and endured and
so forth. That's very true. Many of the chaplains in the chaplain book are now doing work on how to minister and how to work with soldiers who are suffering from post-traumatic stress.
Right, right. We did a book on someone wrote a book about. Well, he was a sufferer of that, and he said, didn't he say there is no cure? There really is no cure for
that.
Yeah,
yeah. I wasn't here when you did that one on your own.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It was good. It was good.
That was
We've had so many interesting, you know, these people that say, well, you know, with the internet and everything, there's not going to be books anymore. I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
I don't care how they read them.
So, Nancy, we have just a couple of minutes, but we always like to talk a little bit about our author's writing process. Do you, you know, sit down and write all day? Do you do things in shorter blocks of time? Do you write everything first and then go back and edit, or do you edit as you write? You know, tell us a little bit about your process.
I suppose everyone's different, but given that a lot of my career was as a deadline writer, a reporter, I love a good deadline. So I love to work, you know, from the minute I get up to the minute my son walks through the door in the afternoon. My favorite days are the days when I've got notes in front of me and I can go ahead and start writing a story. It is working at home. It can be hard to separate your personal life from your work life. So I don't know how successfully I navigate that, but I try. One thing I've learned, and this has served me well throughout my whole writing career, I don't even remember who told me this, but someone said to me, leave something undone at the end of the day so that you know where to start in the morning. And it was such a good word for me, because being the deadline writer, I wanted to have everything off my desk by the end of the day. I wanted to be done. But the idea of leaving something was such a revelation, because it works. It gets you started in the morning. You know where to start. You're not facing any blank pages or blank screens.
That's a good idea.
That's a great piece of advice to wrap up our show today.
Yes.
So, thank you so much for being with us, Nancy. This is Nancy Kennedy, Miracles and Moments of Grace, Inspiring Stories from Doctors. Her book's available from leafwoodpublishers.com or from your local independent bookstore and or the other places where we buy books. and stay in touch and let us know when your next book comes out, Nancy.
Yes, please do.
When the mom book comes out, maybe you'll have me back on.
We'll talk to you again.
Yeah.
And Caroline, you have some parting words of wisdom for us?
Yes, since it's my birthday, I'm going to do this. This is from Bob Dylan, who is entertainer and songwriter. I'm a firm believer in the longer you live, the better you get.
I believe that too. Happy birthday, Mom. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.